Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, as always, and today I'm joined by Dr. Elliot Sober, E. Zenz Reichenbach Professor and William F. Viles Research Professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Sober is noted for his work in philosophy of biology and general philosophy of science. He's the author of books like Philosophy of Biology, Unto Others, The Evolution and Psychology of Unselfish Behavior, and The Design Argument. So, Dr. Sober, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
I'm happy to be on the show with you.
Okay, great. So, our conversation today will revolve mostly around group selection, what it means, how it works, and then behaviors that we usually associate with group selection, like for example, altruistic behavior and things like that. But let me just start with a question that I think is very important because every time I get someone on the show to talk about group selection, there's always some disagreement to start off with about what is a group. I mean, from a from an evolutionary perspective, let's put it that way, what would be a group?
Okay, the definition I like is something that was invented by my friend and co-author David Sloan Wilson. It's the idea of a trait group, which I'll now explain. So, suppose we have a group of wild dogs that hunt cooperatively, and the cooperativeness of each individual is a trait that they each have. And what makes those individuals in that group a group, in the sense relevant to units of selection, is that the fitness of each individual in the group is affected by whether the other individuals cooperate or do not cooperate. That's what distinguishes that group of individuals from a mere collection of individuals that are each living independently of each other. They may be spatially close to each other, but they don't count as a group in the relevant sense for group selection.
Yeah, and I mean, when we talk about a group, the individuals that compose the group, they do not necessarily have to be genetically related to one another, like happens with, for example, in the case of kin selection, right?
That's correct. They don't have to be closely related to each other. In fact, they do not even need to be in the same species. So this is not the what I'll now describe is not the usual understanding of what group selection is all about. I mean, group selection is traditionally be understood as the process in which groups of conspecific individuals in the same species, compete with other groups of individuals in the same species. That's the usual format. But the framework I'm talking about also applies to groups that are themselves multi-species communities. So consider the relationship between you and the microbiome that's inside your gut. There are billions of there Many, many millions of organisms in there, tens of thousands of different species of microorganisms, and you and your microbiome affect each other's fitness. And if so, that would count as a unit of selection from the point of view of what is usually called community selection rather than group selection, which is usually a term that's restricted to within species groups, single species groups.
So I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the biggest aspects of behavior that people apply group selection to is altruistic behavior. But are there other kinds of behavior that that could also derive from group selection? I mean, I would guess that they would all have to operate at a social level, right?
So altruism is certainly, as you say, the central subject that has historically made people be interested in group selection.
Yeah.
Historically, that's why Darwin brought up the theory in the first place, and subsequently too. And altruism, the way it's defined in evolutionary biology, is the following kind of trait. It's beneficial to the group if you're altruistic, but it's bad for you in terms of survival and reproduction if you're altruistic. So altruism is good for the group and bad for the individual altruist. And symmetrically, the way selfishness is defined is that it's bad for the group if everybody is selfish, but good for the individual to be selfish. Mm-hmm. So the way in this traditional definition, you're talking about, and then the way that it then gets developed by multi-level selection theory is that group selection will cause altruism to increase in frequency. Competition among groups will be such that groups of altruists will outcompete groups of selfish individuals. But if you look inside of a group that contains both selfish and altruistic individuals, the selfish individuals are doing better than the altruists in the same groups, because the altruists are giving away benefits to selfish individuals. The selfish individuals are getting those benefits, but are never paying the cost of making altruistic donations themselves. So the picture that I just described is group selection favors altruism. Individual selection, that is selection within groups, favors selfishness. You have group and individual selection pushing in opposite directions. The one is pushing altruism to increase in frequency. The other is pushing selfishness to increase and therefore altruism to decline in frequency. So they're opposing forces when you're talking about altruism and selfishness. Okay, so now I can answer your question. Yes, there are traits that are not altruistic where it's of interest to see how group selection affects their evolution. The simplest example of this, which is not the only example, the simplest example is a trait that is both good for the individuals that have it and also benefits the groups in which it occurs. And there's an example of this that I describe in my book, Did Darwin Write the Origin Backwards? That Darwin came up with. He talks about human groups and the trait of technological innovation. And his idea is that to be an innovator in a group is good for you because you're prestigious, you get benefits by being innovation, but the members of your group learn from your innovations and copy them, and therefore the group is better in its competition with other groups which lack innovators. So that being a technological innovator, being inventing a new axe or a new plow, can be good for the individual and also good for the group, and therefore it's favored by both group and individual selection. So that's one sort of simple example where group selection can play a role in a trait's evolution, even though it's not being opposed at the individual level. Mm-hmm. I could describe a little bit more complicated example, but maybe that'll be sufficient for now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and when it comes to group selection, do you agree that there are two different kinds? I mean, that we have on the one hand genetic group selection, and on the other, at least for the species that have this trait, that have cultural group selection? Do you think that there's that distinction and that both exist, or do you think that's a confusion there?
Well, they are different. Let's call one of them genetic and let's call the other cultural, and those are distinct. And you can have each of them without the other, so they are really distinct. But to me, it's not that there are two kinds of group selection, there are two definitions of group selection. There's one definition of group selection.
Sure.
But what's different here is how individuals transmit their traits to the next generation. Mm-hmm. One way is to have genes passed from parent to offspring. Another is to have ideas passed by culture and teaching and learning from one generation to the next. So there's genetic transmission and cultural transmission. There are two modes by which one generation influences the traits of another, two modes of inheritance, if you like. But there's one concept of group selection that applies to both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to articulate this question correctly because it's a bit complicated, but I mean, let's say that we have group selection operating on a particular group and then that group is more successful than the other. I mean, probably the traits that are the most successful will increase in frequency over time in that group that transmits those kinds of successful behaviors, right? So
are you talking now about cultural group selection or individual group selection, or sorry, cultural group selection or genetic group selection, or both?
I was talking more about genetic group selection because okay. Let me just see if I can take my thinking until the end. So I was trying to ask if so within the same group there's variation between individuals, right? But then probably there is a higher percentage of individuals that perform a certain kind of behavior and a minority of them that do other things, let's say, but over time, because the majority are more successful, little by little that behavior increases in frequency. So that means that, for example, if we are talking about a trait that is transmitted to the individuals culturally, then it also has an effect at the genetic level, and so it also affects genetic evolution, right? I'm not sure.
The fact that a trait is favored by selection helps individuals to survive and reproduce. That does not entail that the trait has a genetic basis. So think of cultural traits, which are, think of two groups of people. Some groups are good cooperators. Some individuals are good cooperators. Other individuals are selfish. And the way these two behaviors are transmitted to the next generation is not that there's a gene for altruism and a gene for selfishness. Suppose parents just teach their children to be like themselves, so that my children, if I'm altruistic, will also be altruistic, and if I'm selfish, my children will be selfish. That's enough to get the trait to change in frequency, depending upon which of the two traits is favored by selection. Okay, so you don't need it. It's not true that if there's cultural group selection, that there must be some sort of genetic basis for it. That does not need to be there at all. Mm-hmm. There's one other detail that I think I should mention also. If you're talking about so if you have two traits and one is fitter than the other, mm-hmm. In a group, then unless you tell me something more about the story, then the prediction is that the fitter trait will increase in frequency. Yeah. But by that definition, altruism is less fit than selfishness within groups. So if all you had going on was a single group, isolated group, with some altruistic and some selfish individuals, then your expectation is that selfishness is going to go to 100% and altruism will go to zero. And if I had not one, suppose I have not just one isolated group, but 100 isolated groups, well, the same sort of process will occur in each of those isolated groups, and selfishness will disappear from the 100 groups in it as a totality. Mm-hmm. So the question then is, well, so how can altruism evolve then? Well, the groups can't be isolated from each other. They don't just sit there and with the clock ticking inside and altruism declining in frequency in each generation. You have to have the groups sometimes going extinct, and or sending out migrants to form new groups. And then you have the opportunity that maybe altruism can evolve. But if the groups are isolated and static, they just sit there, there's no way that altruism can evolve by group selection.
Mm-hmm. I understand. And since we're focusing so much on altruism, are there really genuinely self-sacrificial behaviors that are part of our evolutionary legacy? Because from a purely, I guess, Darwinian or at least from the perspective of the of our modern evolutionary synthesis, and particularly if we are talking about the gene eye view, or that is a vision that is centered on the gene, it is really hard to explain some behaviors that entail that sort of thing, that the individual self sacrifices for another one or for a group without any direct gain, even through even by saving individuals that are not genetically related to it, for example.
You're asking for an example in human evolution, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly applied to you.
Okay, because there are other, of course, other examples one could look at here.
Yeah.
I think what's a little difficult here is, let me just stop that sound. I don't want to go there. Darwin has a very good example in The Origin of Species where he talks about the norm of self-sacrifice in wartime. He says, brave men in times of war come to the front and risk their own lives to defend the group. And he says it's very doubtful that these brave men are more reproductively successful than the men who hold back and don't go to war. But group selection is a process in which groups of cooperators will outcompete groups of selfish individuals. And Darwin thought this was a key to understanding why cooperation and self-sacrifice are parts of the norms of pretty much every society that's ever that we know about. It evolved. How did it evolve? He thought it evolved by group selection. Now, people who don't like the idea of group selection will say, well, Darwin said that, but it turns out the groups were historically made of individuals who were very closely related to each other. And somehow that makes it cease to be group selection. I disagree with that. I think that group selection can occur in groups of relatives and groups of non-relatives. Let me give you an example. This is a real case in anthropology in which the groups are not closely related to each other. So there was this classic example in 20th century anthropology of the ongoing struggle between these two tribal groups in Africa called the Nuer and the Dinka. One of them were extremely good cooperators in wartime. The others were very disorganized, isolated hamlets from each other, and the cooperative group triumphed. One of the ways warfare worked between these two groups was that kidnapping took place, and individuals were routinely kidnapped from one side and brought into the other side, and children, and raised to be a part of their new group, and they became Nuer and Dinka by adoption. Now, these are not groups. These are not groups that are defined by genetic relatedness. They're defined by a cultural norm that they're living together, they're helping each other, or they're living together and being selfish with each other. But the idea that human evolution is all about these genetically isolated pockets is probably radically wrong. There's been a giant amount of migration, sometimes voluntary, sometimes involuntary, as in the case of kidnapping. This is part of human history. It doesn't mean that it shows the limitation of thinking that group selection can only cause cooperation to evolve when the groups are made of very closely related, genetically closely related individuals.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about these traits that might have evolved through some group selection process, can we call them adaptations? I mean, are there adaptations at a group level, or do we only get them at an individual level, and then those traits we can call them, I mean, another thing, and what would that be?
Well, let me try to answer your question by telling you my definition of adaptation. So, as a trait is an adaptation, just means that it became common in the system that you're talking about because there was natural selection for that trait. Okay, and then I can tell you what group adaptation means. It means that the trait became common because there was group selection for that trait. And individual adaptation means the trait became common because there was individual selection for that trait. So yes, I think there are group adaptations. That is, there are traits that have evolved in human history and in many other species as well, because there was group selection favoring that trait.
And if there's some trait that we've acquired at through group selection, I mean, let me reframe the question. If we have group selection, if group selection is real, at least for explaining why some traits have evolved, it doesn't really trump or replace other levels of selection, like the individual one and others, right?
Absolutely. So the framework that David Wilson and I like, we call multi-level selection theory. Group selection is just one level. We have in the old should the idea of individual selection is also there. There's group selection. Above, within species group selection, there's there's community selection, which where the groups are multi-species communities. And then also way down below the individual level, there is intragenomic conflict, where the genes within a single organism compete with each other. So but forgetting about the community selection, the basic idea that we have is three levels: group selection, where you have groups of conspecific individuals competing with other groups of conspecific individuals; individual selection means that individuals in the same group compete with each other. And then intragenomic conflict is a situation in which the genes inside of a single individual compete with each other. Cancer is an example of that. Cancer cells replicate faster than normal cells in an organism's body, but that's bad for the group of cells, bad for the organism.
I understand. And I mean, you mentioned community level selection. I know that there was a time, I'm not sure who was the person that proposed this, or if it were several people. There was a time where people talked about or proposed that there also could be species level selection. Do you think that proposal has any merit or not, and why?
I'm not up to date on the literature in this, but what I remember from the 1980s was Steve Stanley's work on this and Stephen Jay Gould's work on this. And the idea is of species selection is that, suppose we start with two species, and the first species speciates faster than the second species does. So if you look forward in time, you'll find that this species has 100 descendant species, and this species has only 60. And the reason there are so many, let's call this type A and this type B, the reason you have so many A species and so few B species up here later in time, whereas you start with half and half A and B, is species selection. So it's selection for the ability to give birth to new species. That's the special wrinkle in the idea of species selection. It's very different from group selection as traditionally understood, which isn't about speciation at all. Remember, in traditional thinking about group selection, you have a single species. Individuals live in different groups, and the groups compete against each other. There's no speciation event going on there, you see? So the species selection idea was a very new idea when Gould and Steve Stanley and other people put it on the table. Now, what I don't know about is whether there are many sort of real-world cases that that are plausibly interpreted as results of species selection. It may be that, I don't know, it may be that it was a speculation and it failed to turn up, that people failed to find evidence for it, or maybe there are 100 different examples that have been developed. So I've kind of lost track of the literature. I haven't followed that literature. Okay. But conceptually, it's interesting that species selection is different from the usual understanding of group selection, which deserves to be thought of as a different category.
Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the claims that people that oppose group selection, particularly at the genetic level, bring to the table have to do with the fact that they say that phenomena like kin selection and reciprocal altruism would be enough to explain the level of altruism that we usually find right between humans. So do you think that those two mechanisms, evolutionary mechanisms, would be enough to explain these behaviors that we are talking about or not?
Well, as I mentioned, I think there are plausible cases of group selection where the groups are not made of closely related individuals. So that's not kin selection anymore.
Yeah.
So let me just stick with that side of the question. Also, there's a separate point here. So there's, first of all, the cases I just of group selection where the individuals are not closely related to each other. There's also the case in which it's important to realize that kin selection is group selection where the groups are made of close relatives. So to me, kin selection is not a different category. It's group selection where this special feature is present, namely the individuals are closely related to each other. So I don't regard kin selection as an alternative to group selection. I think it's a kind of group selection. I should mention here that Hamilton, the inventor of inclusive fitness, Maynard Smith was the one who invented the idea of kin selection, but Hamilton very early in his career recognized that that the idea of inclusive fitness, which talks about genetic relatedness, he came to realize that genetic relatedness is not essential for the kind of process that he was describing. What's important is that altruists interact with altruists and that selfish individuals interact with other selfish individuals. Whether the altruists who are interacting with each other are siblings or not related, and the selfish individuals who are interacting with each other, whether they are siblings or not related, is irrelevant. It's correlation between similar individuals interacting with similar individuals. That's the key to getting altruism to evolve. So the whole idea that inclusive fitness is all about genetic relatedness, Hamilton in the 1960s realized that that's a mistake. The first examples he was thinking about were similarity owing to shared, you know, being closely related genealogically, but he recognized that that wasn't essential. So kin selection, I mean, by his own view, kin selection is just one example of how his idea of inclusive fitness applies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because back in the 70s, particularly with prominent people like Richard Dawkins, the gene-centered approach became very prevalent, and probably it's still the dominant one nowadays in evolutionary biology. Do you think that...
I don't agree. It depends where you're talking about. I think that in Britain, I think the influence of Hamilton and Maynard Smith, and with Dawkins as a popularizer of that, it's still true that there's a lot of anti-group selection sentiment. In North America, I don't think that's true. I think that there are lots of people who are open to the idea of group selection. They don't think group selection explains everything. You know, I don't think that. But the idea that it's not a stupid, destructive idea is just one among several possible mechanisms that ought to be in the biologist's toolkit. I think that's a very common attitude in a lot of the world. So it's more mixed. The situation, and I think in the United States and many other countries, is more mixed in terms of sentiment. But Britain is where, you know, Dawkins had his influence. The influence, by the way, was not by his own research, but by his popularizing the research of other people. But that remains a dominant thing, Hamilton especially being, and Maynard Smith also being. Those are the two architects of the anti-group selection picture in Britain, I think.
Yeah, thank you for the correction. But the question I was about to ask is if the sort of gene-centered approach, if it doesn't have some limitations or drawbacks because it makes people too centered on the gene, and then it's hard to move up from there in terms of the rationale that people apply when they focus on the gene as the unit of selection.
Yes, I mean, if you think that all of evolution is about genetic transmission, that's a limited view. We talked already about cultural evolution. There are plenty of group selectionists who agree that the gene is the mechanism of inheritance. So it's not true that if you think genes are really important, that you'll be against group selection. Many group selectionists think the gene for altruism has evolved by group selection. There's no contradiction in that. It's a very standard view. Another comment relevant to, I think, what you're asking about. I think of the way Dawkins used the idea of genic selection, of the gene's eye point of view. He wanted it to be anti-group selection, and that was part of the idea. But the idea that it's genes that change frequency is not an anti-group selection idea. Of course genes change frequency. That's what evolution is. And sometimes they do so because of group selection. So the limitations that I see coming out of Dawkins's and Maynard Smith's idea, not Hamilton, because as I mentioned, he changed his mind a long time ago before he died. The limitation is not that is to think that because you think genes are important, you will ignore the possibility of higher level kinds of selection, like group selection. That's unfortunate. That's an unfortunate consequence of the gene's eye point of view. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that whenever we get into these discussions surrounding, for example, selfishness and altruism and how these traits evolved, that the way we frame the discussion derives from, for example, our own folk psychological intuitions that we have about our own and other people's behavior, that we think that we are more or less selfish or more or less altruistic, or at the academic level, it derives from the historical legacy of what happened, particularly in the last century in evolutionary biology?
Well, I think both of these are important influences on the way people, you know, if you teach in a university and you're introducing this subject to undergraduates, which I'm going to do this fall, remotely and synchronously, by the way. Yes, you have to. There are two kinds of influence. There is the ideas in the popular culture of your country about whether people are inherently selfish or are sometimes good cooperators and altruistic. There's that set of attitudes which the students will walk into the classroom with. And then separately, there is internal to the development of evolutionary biology, there are a set of ideas and controversies that will shape what's presented, and the students will react to that in some way or other. So just to help a little bit with that first category, I mean, one of the things that I think is really important in getting students to understand what the biological question is about, the evolutionary question is about, is to get them to see that when evolutionary biologists talk about altruism and selfishness, they're not talking about mental attitudes. Mm-hmm. They think altruism means I care about you. Selfishness means I only care about myself. So organisms can behave altruistically, basically using themselves. So a plant that produces chemical that kills insects that might eat that plant.
Yeah.
And it drops some of that insecticide on a neighboring plant. Now, a biologist will say that that behavior is altruistic. It costs the first plant some energy to produce this chemical. It doesn't come for free. And it's benefiting its neighbor by dropping some of the insecticide on the neighbor. So that will count as an altruistic characteristic. And it's no part of this idea that the first plant cares about its neighbor. It doesn't even have a mind. Think of the plants as mindless organisms. But you can still talk about altruism and selfishness there. So this is maybe the first conceptual step, maybe, in getting an understanding of the evolutionary problem, which is to separate it from the psychology. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the psychology can be brought in later, but to start with, you have to think about altruism and selfishness as behaviors, not as psychological motivations. I mean, I think the psychology can be brought in later, but to start with, you have to think about altruism and selfishness as behaviors, not as psychological motivations.
So I remember that in your book and to others that you co-authored with David Sloan Wilson, at a certain point there you talk about the averaging fallacy and how it influences how biologists think about group selection. So could you tell us about that and what is the kind of influence that it has over biologists?
Okay, so let's continue with the example of altruism and selfishness. And let's imagine a number of different groups, each containing some altruists and some selfish individuals. Yeah. And here are the two facts about the groups I'm talking about that you want to bear in mind, that inside of each of those groups, the selfish individuals are out competing the altruists. Mm-hmm. And the second fact is that altruistic groups do better than selfish groups in their competition with each other. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the way I've described it, another way to say what I just said is there's group selection for altruism, between group selection for altruism, and within groups there's individual selection for selfishness. So we have group selection here.
Yeah.
Okay, just now it's a quantitative question whether altruism will increase in frequency or go down. That'll depend on some details that I haven't mentioned. But just from the beginning, I hope you can see that given the way I've defined group selection and individual selection and the way I've defined altruism and selfishness, in the example I've described, you've got both group selection and individual selection going on. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I will now perform, and let me add one more detail. Suppose that with further details about the example that I haven't mentioned, altruism increases in frequency, mm-hmm. and selfishness goes down in the whole ensemble of these 100 groups, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay. here's the averaging fallacy at work. It says, well, look, if you looked at the if altruism has gone up in this 100 group ensemble, then the average altruist has to have a higher fitness than the average selfish individual. And because of that, I'm just going to let's call them A and S. A has a higher average fitness than S. Oh, well, then I'm going to call that individual selection. So there's no way there could be group selection in the example you described, because the trait with the higher fitness increased in frequency. Mm-hmm. Now, I regard that as a fallacy, because it means that no matter what evolves, A or S, you're going to call it individual selection by just defining individual selection as whatever actually increases in frequency. If S goes up in frequency, you'll say there was individual selection for S. If A goes up, it's always individual selection. There's, by definition, group selection cannot enter into your description of the process. So there's averaging. So let's take averaging fallacy and break it into pieces. Well, first, why is there averaging? Well, you're looking at these 100 different groups, and you're looking at the fitness of altruism within each group, and then you're computing the average fitness of altruism in the 100 group ensemble. So that's where the averaging comes in. That's not a fallacy by itself. That's just, you did the math and you got the correct number for the average fitness of altruism. The fallacy is the argument that since A increased in frequency, it's automatically individual selection that's done the work. Mm-hmm. But the way I tried to explain it, A is actually selected against at the group level. And if A increases in frequency, it's because of group selection. So the averaging fallacy is the idea that no matter what evolves, it's always got to be due to individual selection, because if one trait is fitter than another on average, it's the one that's going to increase in frequency. That's a definitional matter. Mm-hmm. And by definition, group selection can't cause any trait to evolve, which is a crazy conclusion. And that's why the argument is a fallacy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now shifting gears a little bit, what was the role that social rewards and punishments played in the evolution of human altruism?
I can describe a theoretical idea. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm in a position to tell you to answer the question you really asked, which is how important was this in the overall contours of human evolution? I mean, let me just talk about the conceptual thing. Yeah. So we often think of punishing others as not altruistic at all, because you're not being nice to the individual you're punishing. You're hurting them rather than helping them. So from that point of view, the fact that in many, you know, in lots of societies, possibly all societies, some individuals punish other individuals, you think, well, that's not an example of altruism. You shouldn't think about group selection here. It's, well, what are you doing? This is all pure selfishness behavior. That's what punishment is. But here's the important idea. Suppose you have an antisocial individual who is punished by one individual, and the punishing causes that individual to stop performing the behavior or to perform that antisocial behavior less. Now the person doing the punishing has incurred a cost by punishing the antisocial individual, and all the other individuals in the group get a benefit by that individual being the bad guy, so to speak. So that's why in this literature people talk about altruistic punishment. And it seems like a contradiction. It's like a crazy idea, because how can something be both punishing and altruistic? The answer is you're punishing the antisocial individual, and you're benefiting not that individual, but the rest of the group.
Yeah.
So that's how punishment has become a subject in group selection thinking. as a possible place where group selection might have occurred in human societies, other possibly in other species also. And what's interesting about a lot of altruistic punishing is that it does not involve a giant cost to the punishing individual. So we often, when we think about altruism, we often think of extremely costly things like, you know, I sacrifice my life to save your life. I mean, that's a big cost that I've paid to help you out and maybe other people. And you start with that kind of vivid example of altruism and you think, well, how's that going to evolve? Okay, let's put that to one side. Here's a kind of altruistic behavior that is very low in cost to the individual. So suppose you live in a society where antisocial individuals are shunned by others. Do you know what the word shun means? It means ignored, that you don't interact with those individuals. The people who shun the antisocial individual are often going to pay a very modest price. They're not going to sacrifice their life. And so you can get, so it's going to be easier to get that kind of altruistic behavior to evolve than extreme altruism, which involves sacrificing your life to help the group. So that punishment is a way in which less costly altruistic behaviors can sometimes evolve.
Mm-hmm. So let's say that us as humans or even other social animals through natural selection have evolved a set of behaviors that they deploy to interact with others, to decide to cooperate or to compete depending on this and that condition or circumstance. With that set in place, how do we move from those kinds of intuitions, let's say, up to social norms?
Okay, I'll check back to you on whether I've actually understood your question right, but I think, let me try this. So it's one thing to get individuals to behave, the subject has largely been the evolution of cooperative behaviors.
Yeah.
And you find cooperative behaviors in many, many species and not limited to human beings. And when you focus on human beings and you get interested in social norms, it's kind of a new kind of question, because we don't have, you don't need social norms to enforce the kinds of behaviors that people very naturally are going to do anyhow. You mean we don't need laws to say don't stick a nail in your head, because people are not inclined to do that very much. And you don't, so one of the interesting things about social norms is why do they evolve? I mean, why aren't we just a group of individuals who sometimes help others, sometimes we don't, and that's it. No social norms, no institutions of law, no religious teachings. So this sort of cultural thing that's really uniquely human is an interesting puzzle. And
And I think that was exactly the kind of question that I was trying to ask, but in other words. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great question. And that's a place where human beings really are unique. And, you know, it might be the case that we can explain social norms in the same way we explain cooperative behaviors in species that don't really have cultures, maybe. On the other hand, maybe we need to think about new processes that are going on. Why do societies with norms do better than societies without any norms? I mean, that would be a way to formulate it as a group selection question where you're focusing on the norms. And it will be interesting to see whether there are some societies which have norms about certain behaviors, whereas other societies, everybody does those behaviors, but they don't need any norms to do them. And that would be an interesting different to explore inside of the human species.
And going back to multi-level selection, I mean, I'm saying going back to because we've already mentioned it several times during our conversation today. How do you look at multi-level selection? Is it like some sort of pyramid that starts with the gene as the basic unit of selection, and then it moves up to, for example, I know tissues, and then organs, and then individuals, and then groups, and I mean, what I'm trying to ask is if each level is nested within the previous one, and the ones that are at the bottom pose some constraints on the ones that are above them.
Yes, there's nesting here. So the three levels that there are other levels to consider. Let's consider the three: intragenomic conflict. That's the competition of genes with other genes that live inside of the same organism, like you or me.
Yeah.
Then there's individual selection, which is the competition among individuals that all live in the same group.
Yeah.
Then there's group selection, which is the competition between different groups that exist in a single species. Let's just keep it there. And you see you have a part-whole relationship among these. Okay. So very definitely the idea of multi-level selection theory is it begins with the idea of this nested hierarchy. Part whole, part whole. Okay. I would not want to describe that as saying that that genes are the basic, the most fundamental unit of selection. They are one unit of selection at the lowest level of organization. They're the smallest part that I mentioned in this three-level hierarchy. So it's one unit of selection. And the question is, how much of evolution by natural selection involves intragenomic conflict? And I think there's plenty of it. But maybe even more important is the kind of selection that it goes on at the second level and also at the third level. So many of the phenotypes we have are the result of individual selection and group selection, not intragenomic conflict. Mm-hmm. So we have three different levels of selection possible. Which of them are important depends on which traits you're talking about. Which are most important overall is a further question too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, for example, isn't it the case that since genes are basically the building blocks of an organism, that the way by which they are organized and the kinds of genes that each species or each individual has impose some constraints on the individual and the group level of selection, because they basically only allow for a limited set of variation between individuals, I guess.
I don't think of genic selection as limiting individual and group selection any more than I think of individual selection as limiting genic selection. They both occur, and the outcome depends on quantitative features of the three different processes. Mm-hmm. So I don't put one of them in the driver's seat as opposed to the other. It really depends on the details. And one trait can evolve mostly because of group selection. A second trait can evolve mostly because there's individual selection. And a third can arise mostly because there's intragenomic conflict.
Okay, I understand.
And lots of phenotypic traits evolve because all three of these processes are interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just ask you about one last topic. So Many people nowadays are talking about the extended evolutionary synthesis, that is to add some aspects of evolution that have been neglected in the modern evolutionary synthesis in evolutionary biology. And people talk, for example, about language and symbolism, about epigenetics, and cultural evolution even. So, I mean, what's your take on this issue? Do you think that we would really need an extended evolutionary synthesis to account for all of these other processes that people have been putting aside a little bit since the development of the modern evolutionary synthesis, or not?
I think of these new ideas as being very important. I regard them as adding to what we already had, not replacing it.
Sure.
So sometimes one has the impression that what's being suggested is a revolution in which we throw out this old stuff and just start with this new, more comprehensive theory. I don't feel that way. I feel that it's actually a process of completion and adding to what we have already learned. That's what epigenetics is. That's what the study of development is. Niche construction is another example. These are all very important biological questions, and they help us have a more complete picture of how evolution works. Mm-hmm. More power to them.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that any of these new processes or mechanisms or some sort of phenomenon that people are talking about should be included in the evolutionary synthesis will or would replace any of the ones that we've already studied a lot and are more or less well studied?
I mean, I suppose you could find people who will say that Nietzsche construction doesn't exist, and that claim has to be replaced. And you could probably find people who've once said that development doesn't matter, and that needs to be replaced. That's wrong. But I think for the most part, it's just that people didn't attend to these subjects very much, and that was a mistake. And so what we're going to do is fill in the gaps here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you think, I mean, just one last question. Do you think that, for example, things like language, symbolism, culture, and aspects like those, if we include them after we have a better grasp of how they work and the kinds of influences that they have over the evolution of a particular species, in this case they apply, I guess, mostly to humans, that we will get a clearer picture of how different humans are from other species, like, for example, the fact that we have what we could call a full-fledged language, we have with the syntax and all of those things set in place, and also symbolism and cumulative culture. Do you think that would help us get a clearer picture of our place in relation to other species?
Yeah, I agree with you there. Culture and language have created an environment in which we evolve that's different from the environments that other species have experienced, and that's an important. It's like temperature has an effect on what traits evolve. Language and culture have to have that sort of influence, I think, on the way human beings have evolved. So because it creates this incredibly new environment for us. That's a separate question from how did language and culture arise in the first place, which is also very important. But once it's in place, it's got to be gigantic in its influence. I mean, think of the fact that in the light of the current pandemic, think of the fact that we live so close together. Hunter-gatherers didn't do that. Yeah. The the kind of epidemic that we're experiencing now couldn't have arisen where you had scattered groups. It would wipe out a group and then it would go extinct. Well, that doesn't happen when you have billions of human beings interacting, flying all over the planet. So that's a simple example of how epidemiology is profoundly influenced by the cultural context in which human beings now live.
Yes, and that's also interesting because from a group selection point of view, because nowadays we move quite a lot and over longer distances, and there are people from all sorts of origins in all places we can imagine. I mean, the dynamics there are much more complex than they were until, I don't know, 10,000, 13,000 years ago, before particularly the development of agriculture, when we were mostly hunter-gatherers, right?
Right. Absolutely. I agree with you.
Okay, so Dr. Sober, before we go, would you like to mention any places on the internet where people can find your work?
I have a website whose address I don't remember, but I have a lot of my papers and also teaching materials that I use in the classes that I teach that are available there. So that's on the subject that we've talked about today. My book with David Wilson, Unto Others, is still in print, so that's something to look at. One thing that I think I did not mention this. I have a smaller book about Darwin called Did Darwin Write the Origin Backwards that talks about Darwin's views about group selection, which I think is interesting, partly because people who have been against group selection, since they regarded Darwin as a saint, they had to show that he really didn't believe in group selection. This is not true.
Yeah, it's always fun to follow those historical, those fights between some very big names in the history of evolutionary biology, right? And even nowadays, because these are very, very complex topics to talk about and to try to figure out, right? So, and Dr. Sober, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show, and it was a really fun conversation. So thank you again.
You're welcome, Ricardo. I enjoyed our conversation.
Hello everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel back in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. And I also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and main supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Peruga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klingby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nacio, Arthur Coe, Marco Neves, Max Belby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugney, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Felicia Stevens, Fergal Cusson, Yevon Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Labrant, Oslem Bullet, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, JW, João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sardus France, David Sloan Wilson, and Yasila Deza Araujo. My producers, Izar Weber, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Dr. Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Agdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.